Today is Sunday, April 4th, 2021. This is a Part 9 Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Jim Haggart, spelled H-A-G-G-A-R-T. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Jim. How are you today?
Excellent, Tom. Beautiful day here in Vancouver. Spring day, crisp and clear. How are you doing?
Great. I'm doing very well. Thank you. It's a wonderful day here in Flagstaff. Jim, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Certainly, Tom.
Thank you so much. We left off in the spring of 1995 in Part 8 on a trip you were going to do to Matkatamiba Canyon. I should spell that for the transcribers and butcher it up, I'm sure. M-A-T-K-A-T-A-M-I-B-A. I believe that might be right.
Yeah, that's it.
And you were also hiking with a couple of the guys at that time that became your long-term hiking partners. Can you pick that up?
Yeah, for sure. So the hike you're referencing was done with Art Christensen and Bruce Grubbs, and they had figured very prominently in my earlier hiking and climbing in Arizona. I had climbed with Bruce in central Arizona in around 1970, 71, and also did a number of short day hikes and climbs, and then a 10-day trip with Art from Bass to Boucher in around 75, I believe. So we had climbing and hiking history together, but as we talked about in earlier sessions here, Tom, you know, I had this long break when I went to graduate school, a break from hiking and climbing in the canyon, and kind of hiking and climbing in general. And when I went to graduate school in California, and then more pronouncedly after I moved up to Canada, initially to Ottawa. And you know, that was partly because of my workload as a young scientist in the Geological Survey of Canada, and partly because of my family responsibilities to my partner and my daughter. And you know, life has its demands, and it sometimes takes you in directions you don't plan to go, and mm-hmm. and away from things that you thought you would always be with. And so, yeah, there was a fair hiatus there. But you know, I think I talked about how that relationship that I was in was kind of deteriorating over a number of years, and you know, eventually I made the break with my partner Cheryl, and actually was so fortunate to be able to hook up with Bruce Grubbs through my visit to the airport there in Sedona. I mentioned that on the last
That's
session,
right.
I believe.
That's right.
And so Bruce and I got in touch. And he said, how about we do a trip in the canyon and maybe out onto the Esplanade out by Great Thumb Point? And eventually, you know, after we kind of planned this initially, he said, do you remember Art Christensen? And would you mind if he goes along on the trip? And I said, of course not, right? Let's, you know, Art's a great guy. So the three of us planned to do this. And keep in mind, I hadn't seen these guys for 15 years, you know, and maybe Art for 20. And so it was kind of very interesting for me to undertake this trip. And partly because I hadn't been in the canyon for quite some time, and like 8 years or something like that, and partly because I was going through this emotional turmoil trying to maintain a relationship with my daughter, and in spite of the troubles, and also with the pressures of work and whatnot, you know, weighing on you all the time. But, you know, partly was this mysterious area out on the Western Canyon. When I say Western Canyon, I'm talking about the area of the vicinity map, Grand Canyon National Park in vicinity Arizona, which is the 1962 map that everybody has on their wall, at least I do.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it kind of ends like at Havasu Creek, right?
Right.
So that's been the area of my focus And so this area out to the west was kind of terra incognita to me. I knew from reading Harvey's notes that there were routes down off the mesa, and there were some routes down into the drainages. But even Harvey hadn't done a lot of hiking out there. If you look at his map of that's online, I think it's in the Klein Library, and
That's
is that
right.
the Klein? Yeah. And if you look at that map, you'll see that he's got very few lines reflecting his hikes in that area. And so it kind of was like, this big unknown. And but we decided we were going to take this trip out there. And Art had actually been out into Matkatamiba by the descent route that we went down, which is southeast of Towago Point. He had done that a few years before, and I think it was in the spring, and they got a lot of snow, and he basically they canceled their they cut their trip short and came back out because of the heavy snowfall. But anyways, I met Bruce and Art in Phoenix, and well, probably met Art first in Phoenix, and then drove up to Flag and met Bruce, and then we drove in. I forget which vehicle we had. It would have probably been, I think Art had a Subaru then, and that would have been the vehicle we took. And we drove out, drove the road out to towards Pasture Wash, and then went up onto the Tobacoba Hilltop Road, and then eventually got up onto the Mesa. And it was a
Oh,
little
this
touch
is
and go.
Great Thumb Mesa.
Yeah, that's
Okay.
right, Great Thumb Mesa. So there's an area there where the road's a little rough.
Yeah.
And but Art was able to get up in his Subaru,
Okay.
and so we basically parked the car in the junipers there near Enfilade Point, just to the west. And there's a jeep trail, a road that heads off across the plateau there to the south, to the east. I'm sorry, to the
To the
west,
west.
and slightly south. And so we followed that with our backpacks on, and went past a high point called, it's got an actual benchmark on it called Elliott. And we actually camped there. And I remember it was a cool April night, very cool, and like just around freezing. And I had this brand new sleeping bag because, of course, this was a brand new experience for me, going back to the canyon. And I had went and got myself a new sleeping bag. I got a new down jacket and lots of new gear, to kind of celebrate the return, right? And so I had this new sleeping bag. What's it? Western. Anyways, can't remember the name of it, but beautiful, beautifully constructed Western Mountaineering down bag. And we set up camp under this little juniper there, right near the benchmark. And of course, had a wonderful night, but just on the verge of being chilly, when you're in the sack there. So the morning came soon enough, and with a gorgeous sunrise, and we started down. And I have to say, when I got to the rim, and because keep in mind all the drive up there, we didn't see anything, right?
Right.
And you didn't see any of the canyon, and until we got to the rim of our descent, and here I am seeing the canyon again for the first time in 8 years, and well, in a primal way. I had done the day hikes that I talked about last week, the year before, but this was a new adventure, right? This is going to be a backpack trip into a totally unknown area, and it was really awe-inspiring because the views. Well, you've been out there so much, but the Esplanade is a totally different environment from.
Jim, can you describe that to listeners that don't know what the Esplanade is? Can you kind of set that, paint it for us?
Sure, yeah, be happy to. So this, the area of the Grand Canyon that most people are familiar with is the area around the village. And from the rim, when you look down into the depths of the canyon from around Grand Canyon Village, you can basically see in certain places down to the river, and you're looking down a mile of geology. And through many hundreds of millions, in fact, billions of years of Earth's history recorded in those rocks. And they're all in different layers, right? The rocks are all in different layers. And that's, you know, it's characteristic of the Grand Canyon region that we have these many, many flat layers. And so there are sandstone layers, and there are limestone layers, and there are shale layers.
Mm-hmm.
And each of these layers, because of its different cementation or the way the rocks are cemented together, the grains that comprise the rock are cemented together, they weather in different ways. So some of the sandstones form cliffs, and some of the sandstones weather more easily because they're not as well cemented,
mm-hmm.
and so they form slopes. And the limestones typically form very steep cliffs because they're very well cemented and quite often very thick. Now, the big one in the Grand Canyon, in the main area of Grand Canyon, is called the Redwall Limestone, and it's Mississippian in age, about 400 million years, I believe, something like 450 million years in age. And the red wall is a very major cliff-forming unit, and it's overlain by a series of sandstone rocks, beds, which in total aggregate about 1,000 feet in thickness.
Mm-hmm.
This is called the Supai group of sandstones. In the 60s and 70s, it was called the Supai sandstone, Supai formation, but subsequently there's been a lot of geological work on these rocks, and they've differentiated that package of rocks into a lot of different subunits. But suffice to say that the Supai forms a very prominent series of cliffs with intervening shale slopes. And typically, you know, you'll find three major cliffs in the Supai and then shale slopes beneath those cliffs.
Mm-hmm.
So the top one of these sandstones is called the Esplanade Sandstone. And so it's a very distinctive flat, it forms a very distinctive flat terrace because it is overlain by rocks that are very soft called the Hermit Shale. And the Hermit Shale has weathered very easily, so it erodes back and leaves these big flat sandstone terraces, which are developed on the top of this Esplanade Sandstone bed.
Okay.
And you know, when I say the Esplanade Sandstone, I'm talking about a sandstone interval that's maybe 150, 200 feet thick. These numbers are approximate, but
yeah.
But it, you know, it's a very prominent feature, and so when you get to the western part of the Grand Canyon, where the topography isn't as high, this Esplanade Terrace, in other words, this flat bench on top of the Esplanade Sandstone, has become much more extensive much more dramatically revealed because the younger rocks have eroded away. They've eroded back towards, they've just been eroded away.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you're walking or looking at the canyon from a place, say, at Tuago Point, where we started our trip into Matkat-Amoeba, you basically see huge expanses of this Esplanade Sandstone, very flat, you know, with undulating topography, little buttes here and there. And it's a very distinct contrast to the central part of Grand Canyon, where you see all the way down into the canyon, and the Esplanade Sandstone is a very thin bench. It's very narrow in most places. So it's a very distinct difference in the western part of the canyon, in the topography and the way the geology has been eroded. There's still that river down there, right? If you're looking out across the Esplanade, there's still that river that's down at the bottom, but it's hidden because you can't, you know, you just see sometimes you'll see this narrow trench looking out across the Esplanade, and you know the river's down in there, but you know, from most places you can't actually see the river. So it's a very different setting, and you look down there and onto this terrace, the Esplanade, and you can imagine walking for hundreds of miles, and you can literally if you're so inclined. But of course, you know, people that are exploring want to go places. They want to go down, try to get to the river and explore the side canyons and whatnot. And
Right.
these are basically just gashes. You know, when you're looking from the rim, you just see these big gashes in the Esplanade sandstone terrace, and you know, you really can't see any detail in those gashes because, you know, you have to be directly above and looking down. Anyways, a totally different landscape or geomorphological landscape than exists in the central part of the canyon. I hope I explained that
Yeah,
well.
no, that's good.
Okay. So,
So this is what you were looking at from we got up in the morning and worked out to Tuagua Point and looked out and saw this kind of huge canyon with this big flat bottom and then this in deeply incised canyon in the middle of that.
that's right. But no details of the deeply incised canyon. You know, you know it's there. You can just see, you can see where it is because you can see the cliffs at the top of it. But you can't see anything down inside of it. And so, you know, it's very it's just a very wonderful place to just imagine hiking forever, basically. Anyways, it just had a special effect on me at that time because this was the first time I had ever been out to that area of the canyon, right? And I had referred to Harvey Butchert's notes, and there wasn't a whole lot of detail in that. There wasn't much detail in his books, Grand Canyon Treks, about hiking out there. I mean, there was the discussion about hiking into Havasu Creek. I mean, that's a fairly popular destination and whatnot. So it was really, you know, quite exciting time and kind of awe-inspiring for myself. And, you know, and being with these two guys that I hadn't connected with for 12 or 15 years was pretty neat too. So yeah, it was great. And we started down, and you know, the hiking is, it's straightforward. You have to work back and forth across, you know, various ledges, and you know, the deer trails are just superb. I remember that. You know, going across through the Kaibab and Torweap, there were beautiful deer trails that linked up the various drops, and eventually we worked our way down to that Esplanade level. So we worked now down about 1,200 feet of geology through the Kaibab, the top formation on the rim, and then the underlying Torweap formation, which the Kaibab is a limestone that forms a cliff most
Right.
places, and then the Torweap is more of a sandstone and shale that is more recessive, although it can make small cliffs of its own. So we worked down through those, and also the Coconino, which is another sandstone, and got down onto the Esplanade itself. At the head of Matecatamiba Canyon. So, you know, we were finally down into the canyon, and it's a different, you know, once you get down onto the Esplanade, it's a different sensation than being up above on the rim and looking out across, because you when you're on the Esplanade, you of course you can't see the gashes, you know, where the side canyons are. You can't see the gash where the Colorado River is. All you
Right.
can see is just the sandstone, just going horizontally for miles and miles and miles, and you know intuitively that there's a, you know, a 1,500 foot drop out there somewhere going down to the river, but you cannot see it or get any sense of it.
Right.
So it's a totally different hiking experience, and you know, in a way, for me personally, it's a very relaxing area to go hiking. You know, when you're in the central part of the Grand Canyon, you're always seeing topography, you know, you're working your way down cliffs. You've always got exposure, and you can always see great depths and distance too. But your views are dominated by vertical
Right.
perspective, right? And so there's this overwhelming sense of verticality when you're in the central part of Grand Canyon, and when you're out on the Esplanade, all you see is the flat sandstone. It's very peaceful, very relaxing. And like I said, you feel like you can walk for hundreds of miles. And if you follow the ins and outs of the canyons, you can do that. Mm-hmm. But it was a great introduction, you know, that that trip. And so we actually got down to into Mt. Canemiva and camped there. And so the this was an interesting story because Harvey had actually written about going down Mt. Canemiva and and in his notes, and he talked about traversing this this little ledge in the Supai and getting down into the bed of Mt. Canemiva to pass a dry fall, right? So we thought, well, this won't be a problem. We'll just go down with day packs. So our plan was to go down from our camp, which was just, basically a little bit into the Supai there in the bed of Mt. Canemiva Canyon, and then we were going to try and go down to the river. And so we get up in the morning and put on our day packs and feeling all cool and everything because here we are in the middle of nowhere. And we start down, and, you know, it's beautiful. There were, I remember, typical Esplanade spring. You know, you have these red buds everywhere, right?
And gorgeous.
In the drainages, anyways.
Yeah.
And it's just gorgeous, you know, with these red buds in bloom. And there was a little bit of water in the drainage, so you know you have these open sandstone valleys that you're walking down. They're very narrow, of course, just corridors with little, you know, streams of water, you know, traversing there. And anyways, we're just having a great time walking down, but boom, within about 10 or 15 minutes, we get to the first of these dry falls. I remember it took us quite a bit of time to negotiate through some of the cliffs in the first part of this particular dry fall, you know, back and forth type of thing, checking something out, doesn't go, so you go try something else. And eventually we got down through all but the last drop, which of course was the biggest. And we're reading these notes that we had copied from Harvey's notes, and we brought them along. And it said, you know, you work your way down through the breaks, and then you get to this ledge where you have to traverse horizontally for a couple hundred feet. And then you get to a talus slope. And, you know, we were expecting a piece of cake, really. And we get down there, and we look at this traverse, and it's like, my God, is this the right place, you know? And we looked at that, and we actually started across it. And keep in mind, now we're there with just our day packs, right? And Harvey had done this with a colleague, and they had frame packs.
Wow.
And I'm looking across at this, and I just thought, you know, if it's like you're traversing along underneath an overhang, so there's a sandstone cliff that overhangs above you, and there's a little tiny shale ledge that's maybe 18 inches wide, which is just, you know, sloping and dirt, and then you've got another 50 or 60 foot drop below that, right, vertical. And it's like if something on that shale ledge slips, you know, you're toast.
Right.
We tried it. All three of us started across, and each of us turned around, you know, and just said, can't get the nerve up. And you know, I don't know if I could do that today, right? That particular climb. But I remember thinking at the time, oh man, Harvey, you know, it's just like a god, right? You know, that this guy could do anything, right? So anyways, we basically turned around, and it was kind of like, oh man, there goes our Grand Canyon trip, you know. We were having so much fun, and now it's been kind of snatched away from us. But so we went back up to our camp, and we decided, well, you know, obviously we weren't going to end the trip just because we got stop there, but we knew that we could eventually we were pretty certain we could eventually find a way down into Mt. Cap by going out to the fault that runs from Mount Sinala to the northeast across all these terraces. And
that's
it's
right.
A long fault trace. And
the Sinala Fault.
The Sinala Fault, that's right. And it crosses all these side canyons like Sinala and Matkatamiba and Olo, 140 mile, and then actually goes up onto the north rim too.
Right.
Between Deer Creek and Fishtail, I think. Anyways, that fault we knew was fairly broken, and we knew we could probably get down through the Esplanade, through the Supai, to the Red Wall by going out to that fault, which is exactly what we did. So
okay.
The next day then we worked our way, or later that same day, that this would be the second day of our trip, we worked our way out along the Esplanade to the head of that fault. So this would be the neck of the terrace. It's called Matkatamiba Mesa, actually, which is the terrace between Sinala Creek and Matkatamiba Canyon. And we camped there, and then the next morning we got up and worked our way down this Butte Fault, the Sinala Fault, to the top of the Red Wall in Matkatamiba. And, of course, here you're sitting, you know, you're basically sitting at the top of the Red Wall, and the Red Wall is about 400-foot drop, and, you know, you've got this deep gash of Matkat that you're finding it really, you know, looking at it, and it's really challenging figuring out how you're going to get down into that. But what we did was we backtracked. We hiked south along the rim of the Red Wall, so going farther back upstream towards where we had been the previous day, and we eventually got down to the bed there. There's several ways you can get down through the Red Wall into the bed.
Right.
And I remember before we dropped down through the Red Wall to its bed, I went back. You know, the other two guys relaxed, and I hiked upstream to go take a look at that fall that had stopped us the day before, right from below.
Right.
Yeah, I wanted to see what it looked like from below. I suppose part of me was thinking if I was feeling really gutsy, I might just run up and try and connect, you know, the link. But mostly I just wanted to actually see it and actually just cover the ground. So, you know, I hiked upstream while the other two guys relaxed, and it turns out that there's another cliff of sandstone before you get to that, and I just didn't have the time to figure out how to get through that cliff and beyond that to the base of the slope that led up to the Harvey Traverse. So, you know, I turned around short of it. I could see that traverse from a distance, but I couldn't actually get close to it. So, but it was a nice exploratory little jaunt, and quite honestly, it kind of was a presage of the types of hiking experiences that Bruce and Art and I were going to have over the following few years, because I know that, you know, Bruce is a fantastic hiker and he's very organized, but he's very content to just walk and rest and stop and relax and look around and take in the view and write. And he, as you know, he's written many guidebooks, so, you know, he takes that opportunity to just sit down and relax and enjoy his situation. And when he does that, it gives me an opportunity to go do these side hikes, right?
Right.
So everybody's happy in the end, and but that's typically what I do, is I would run off and do something subsidiary. So,
right.
So anyways, we started down Matkat and Matkatamiba Canyon, and we got most of the way down to the river there, and we ran into a party of four walking up.
Oh, cool.
And, yeah, and one of them was Glenn Rink.
Okay.
And who I'm sure you know.
Yeah.
And I knew him, you know, just generally. I don't think I'd ever met him at the time, but, of course, Bruce knew him because I think they both lived in Flagstaff. And,
yep.
And of course, Glenn was a big climber and river runner, and they had actually done Quaggint Butte, the second ascent of Quaggint Butte, on the river trip that they were on that brought them down to Matkatamiba.
Nice.
And I think they'd also done Doc's Castle on that trip. Can't remember for sure. But their planning, so their river party had left them at Matkatamiba. I think they had camped in that general vicinity. You would know where the campsites are there. But and so this Glenn and his friends, I can't remember who the other three were. It was two women and Glenn and another fellow. And they were going up with ropes. They hiked up Matkatamiba, basically the way we were going to go, or the way we had come. And then they were going to follow the Sinyala Fault trace up and over Matkatamiba and down into Sinyala Canyon. And then they were going to walk down Sinyala to the dry falls there, and they had ropes to rappel. So they were going to – they didn't know what they were going to get into, but they had, three or four ropes, I guess, between them. And they were going to rappel down through the red wall and then meet their river party at the rapids there at the base. So they were going to do that in one day, you know.
Wow.
And I thought that was pretty amazing because they didn't know for sure what the drops were going to be like in Sinyala, right? And they had ropes, but, I guess it seems to me you don't know exactly how far apart the rappels are going to be spaced, if it's all one, two rappels or four. Anyways, it just seemed really kind of dicey, right? But obviously they had no problems with it and were successful. But it was funny to run into people in such a remote place. I felt at the time, and I mean, obviously they're river runners and they're seasoned professionals and hikers like we were trying to be, and they knew their way around the canyon. But it was still for me, it was very surprising to see these guys. So
yeah.
And we had a good visit, right? So,
cool.
Yeah. So that was, that trip. Well, we did a lot more hiking. We got down to the river, and there was nobody there. But we because their party had continued downriver, right, after dropping them off. And on the way back up, Matkatamiba, so we just reversed our route. But, of course, I went up. There's an arm on the east that goes up. It's about a mile above the mouth of Matkatamiba. There's an arm that goes to the east.
That's right.
And the two guys waited in the main bed while I ran up there to look at the alcoves in the red wall, right? Because there were drops.
It's
big
pretty
drops.
Impressive. Yeah.
Yeah, and then we continued back up. I can't remember, Tom, exactly where we camped. It would be in my notes. But the next day, we followed now the red wall rim of Matkatamiba on its east side.
Okay.
And we're continuing. Now we're going north along the red wall rim along parallel to the drainage of Matkat. And eventually we turned east. And following the red wall rim, and went up onto the esplanade there, and then to a place called Chickapinagi Point.
Right.
And I'm sure you've heard of that. You know where that is. And so at that point, we're sitting there, and our plan was to hike. Let me see here. I'm getting a little bit confused, I believe. Bear with me a second. I'm looking at my trip maps here to try and refresh. Yeah, okay, that's right. So the plan was to go from Chickapinagi Point and then just continue to follow the Esplanade Sandstone around into the drainage of Olo, and then from in the back of Olo Canyon, there's a trail, an old trail, that gets you up to the rim, and we followed that route. And got up to the rim, and then worked our way over to the Jeep trail that goes out on up onto Great Thumb Mesa.
Right.
And I remember when we came up, we up onto the rim, and out of the canyon, we scared up this huge herd of Roosevelt elk. And
oh, wow.
I mean, I had never been close to elk before. I had seen them, you know, from a distance in many excursions in Montana and Wyoming and the Canadian Rockies when I went camping with my parents. But we managed to just kind of walk right into the middle of a herd of these elk, and of course, we surprised them as much as they surprised us, and everybody jumped, and they start bolting, and there's dust flying everywhere, and you know, these huge, massive torsos of hair and muscle and antlers, and it was quite surprising, you know, and you kind of you don't think about it at the well, maybe you do, but it's kind of a dangerous situation, you know, to be in, because those animals are huge and could bolt and right over you, you know. So, anyways, that was an interesting ending, and of course, we just had to walk the rim back down to where our car was parked.
Right.
And
so, I'm trying to remember this. Is this? I don't have my map with me. Is this the Tahuta Point route?
Oh no. No, Tahuta Point's a different one for sure, and we'll get to that.
Okay, because that's off the Great Thumb. It's just further east of you guys.
Yeah, further east and a little bit north. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
okay.
We'll talk. There's another trip.
Oh, interesting. So you basically got two breaks then down through the Coconino, off the rim, further west of the Great Thumb Point, the Tahuta Point route. Okay, cool.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, you know, I think I said that we went up a trail, and the trail is actually at Tahuta Point.
Okay.
Now that I think about it,
right. There's a trail there, and there's like a gate kind of thing with a horse skeleton up on a high piece of the gate post.
Oh wow!
I think.
I didn't see the skeleton, but yeah, I mean, I take your word on that for sure. Yeah, I remember the gate now that you mention it. Yeah, and so these were breaks that.
Further west. Got it.
Further west, yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, we'd heard about it's not like these were new, right?
Right.
We didn't discover these. We'd read about these. So we knew we were going to be able to get out of the canyon there, right? So, it was a fun trip, I think 4 or 5 days total. And coming back, you know, we got the road there on Great Thumb Mesa. It just goes right along the edge of the mesa there when it's going past Fossil Bay, right?
Yeah, it's a stunning view.
You get fabulous views down into the canyon, and it was a great trip, and what a great reintroduction for me to the canyon, right? So and you know, I have to say, it really opened up my eyes to the Esplanade as a hiking objective.
Nice.
Because, like I say, it's just so much fun to hike there. It's so easy.
Yeah.
I can't believe, you know, how easy it is if you discount the drops, you know, of course, where you're trying to work your way down through the cliffs and whatnot. But the actual hiking on the Esplanade is just, it's so simple. It's open and you're just walking along these beautiful open sandstone slabs. And, of course, you know, every once in a while you need water, right? And if you're in there at the right time of year, you'll have just these beautiful water holes, pockets of water just sprinkled like jewels across this flat sandstone surface.
Yeah.
And basically, you know, if you're planning your trip right and there's been a storm, you know, that allows you to make some of these longer trips because the actual water sources from springs and whatnot are fairly limited. So you really need to take advantage of water pockets wherever you can, but what a tremendous place, you know, area to go hiking. So when, you know, this was like the first time we'd gone out there, any of us, except for Art, who had been to Mad Cat once before, but for a short visit. And I think we were all three really kind of taken with the beauty of it and, you know, the fantastic hiking, right? The ability to cover long distance and the spectacular distant views you have, but then of course you have the opportunity to do these more adventurous objectives like going down the canyons and whatnot. So so it was a great introduction to the Esplanade, and I think that it started to flavor a lot of what we were going to do in subsequent years.
Okay.
So in fact, the next trip we did was somewhat related to that. It was definitely an Esplanade trip, the trip that Art and I did. So, yeah, that was so that was in the spring of '95, and then I'm sorry, '97. No, I'm mixing things up here. That was the April of 1995.
Right.
And I did a couple of short hikes with again with Bruce. We did the Battleship later that spring, and I climbed Coronado Butte with Bruce and Doug Rickard, another river runner friend of yours.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so these were, you know, these are easy climbs, but they were good, you know, introductions to getting back into climbing in the Grand Canyon for me.
But at this point, you're still living and working in Canada.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
so,
at this point,
so when
I
you're
had...
thinking, let's go do a hike in Grand Canyon, it's a major journey for you to go south to get to Arizona.
That's the story of my life for the last 25 years, Tom.
Okay.
Yep, they've all been from Vancouver.
Wow.
Yeah, definitely requires planning, but, you know, fortunately, the airline flights are very amenable because you can, you know, quite often, not now in the time of COVID, of course, but back in those times, you know, you could get like a 7 a.m. flight on America West from Vancouver to Phoenix, and so we could be, you know, camping in the canyon that evening, you
right.
know. As long as you were organized and had all your gear ready to go, et cetera, et cetera.
And Art lives in Phoenix, so he could pick you up at the airport and then take you north.
Perfect. Exactly. And that's exactly the way it worked.
Okay.
Yeah.
What a
I would
great
fly.
Idea.
Yeah, it worked out. It worked out great. And, I mean, that aspect of it, I mean, basically, when you think about it, it's basically me spending an extra 4 hours before he picks me up.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then he picks me up, and then we go do the trip, right?
Right.
So,
right.
And then the another great aspect of it is my family lived in Phoenix.
Ah.
So at the end of the trip, sometimes at the beginning, but typically the end of the trip, I come back to Phoenix, and Art would drop me off at my mother's house, you know, or my sister's house,
mm-hmm.
and I'd get to visit with them for 3 or 4 days, right?
Okay.
And then go back to Vancouver. So.
Got it.
Yeah, I would always try and, you know, combine a family visit with a canyon hike
right.
and vice versa, right?
Yeah.
So, it worked out really well for a long time. So,
nice.
Yeah, yeah. So, but, you know, obviously it's not conducive to spontaneous weekend jaunts, you know
right.
what I mean?
Right.
It definitely
plan
requires
this.
A lot of planning ahead.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And another thing that was really great for me was that Art was a pilot for America West.
Oh.
And a co-pilot.
Oh, right.
Yeah, and first officer, I guess. And I just want to tell this story because Art is such a meticulous a person in everything he does. He's so focused on detail.
Right.
And, you know, he built his own plane at one point and flew in that. And, you know, he's focused on reducing his pack weight fanatically almost.
Right.
And as he tells me, you look after the ounces and the pounds take care of themselves, right? and so, you know, at some points, I mean, he always has a lighter pack than me.
Hmm.
And on a couple of our trips, he was carrying like, he was ending a trip with like 13 pounds.
Wow.
That's his
that's
backpack
great.
Is 13 pounds,
that's
exclusive
great.
Of water,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And I mean, that's the way to go. You know, Art, I wanted to tell this story about Art because it's so instructive. He, you know, he served as a co-pilot, but a, what do you call it, first officer
mm-hmm.
For America West for many, many years, even though he could have assumed captain status,
oh,
right?
Okay.
And be the chief of the flight. But he didn't want to do that because that would... Because as first officer, he was at the top of the seniority pile, and he had the pick of any flights that basically America West flew. He had first pick on those, and he basically structured his flying all those years so that he could maximize his time off.
Yeah.
And Art, of course, has done many, many hikes in Arizona, probably hiked more of the Tonto National Forest than any other person around. You know, having this this career where he kind of limited his advancement allowed him to maximize his personal
right.
you know, enjoyment and value. And I always thought that was a really, really neat observation about him,
yeah.
right? That he was not, he was driven to perfection in the important things in his life, but it was not important for him to become a captain, the chief of the plane, because it would, if it was going to impact his personal hiking experience. And
right.
so anyways, that's at least that's my perspective on it. Art mm-hmm. may have a different take on it, but anyways, him being a first officer with America West, he would get me buddy passes.
Ooh.
So, which was like flying standby.
Okay.
So, you know, you would fly, I could get a ticket with the buddy pass that would be like 60% off, 70% off.
Wow.
Of the standard flight. So, you know, not only was it convenient to get a flight from Phoenix, from Vancouver to Phoenix, but I could do it for, you know, fairly small amount of money with
yeah.
this buddy pass.
That's amazing.
So, anyways, it worked out very conveniently for several decades.
Super.
And we got a lot of hiking done that way.
So what was your next hike after that April Matcat hike in 1995?
Yeah, so I did a number of short trips, like day hikes, right?
Mm-hmm.
With Bruce and Doug, and did these climbs. But Art and I were focused on, you know, we agreed that we wanted to do a trip in the fall
okay.
of 95, and I'm pretty sure that this was going to be a threesome again, you know, with Bruce. I can't
yep.
recall if this is actually the case or not, we decided we wanted to do the area from the Bass Trail over to Fossil Bay in that area.
Okay.
And so we had a nice trip planned out where we were going to go down and follow along the Tonto Trail over to Garnet Canyon, and it kind of disappears, and you work your way down river to Elves Chasm. And then we were going to work our way down river to the Enfilade Point route.
Okay.
And then come back along the Esplanade once we got on top, all the way back to the Bass Trail. So it was a pretty ambitious loop. And we had a lot of objectives, at least I did. Because I had been down in 1977, I think it was, that second float trip I did with Doug Rickard. Yeah, it was June of 77. I had floated with those guys, with Doug and his party at the time, from Phantom Ranch down to Temple Bar. And that was the only time I've ever done a float trip through that part of the canyon.
Hmm.
And one of the things, you know, that I had talked about with Doug before that float trip was, I said, I really want to do some side hiking. You know, I hope you guys have the opportunity to do that. And we did. We did some short things. You know, Doug and I did a couple of hours up Tuck Up. And I remember Travertine Canyon. That's the one with the fall right off the there's a Travertine waterfall.
Yes.
Just above the river.
Right, that's right.
Yeah, and I remember climbing up that and then going upstream. And then we did a couple of day hikes. But nothing that... I shouldn't say day hikes, because they would be hikes that I would take after we beached the boats.
Right.
You know, and
so you get to camp, get camp set up, and then you go hiking.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And nobody else wanted to go hiking except Doug, to a
okay.
certain extent. But most of them were just into relaxing, and so we would get into camp relatively late, which would mean that there'd be a relatively short period of time, right, to go hiking.
Right.
But we managed it. And one of the things I did was on that trip was we camped with the boats. We beached them on the west side of the river, just below Fossil Canyon,
okay.
the mouth of Fossil Canyon. And I was really excited about this because I'd read in Harvey's notes about his route up through the Red Wall
yes.
at Enfilade, below Enfilade Point.
Right.
Yeah, and so I thought, I said, I want to get, you know, try this and see if I can find this route. So I ran, you know, quite literally was moving very fast because it was late in the day. And
so Fossil is about a mile and a half downstream, if I get the numbers right, below the base of the route.
That's right.
And it's late in the day.
That's right.
All right, so you've got a ways to go.
I've got a ways to go, and I don't really know exactly where I'm going, right? Because
okay.
I just knew that it was kind of midway
up there somewhere
between Forster and Fossil.
Right.
And so it's like, okay, find the most logical looking route
yep.
and go for it. And so so anyways, I did that. I'm hiking up river and I'm going as fast as I can because it's getting, you know, it's late in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I say, okay, this has got to be it, right? So I start up. And I start up this gully and this drainage first, and then it goes into a gully.
Right.
And that's kind of the way the route was described, right? You go up the drainage, and there's a couple of small cliffs you work your way past, and then you get into, the drainage gets increasingly steep, and you're working your way up through the boulder talus. But eventually I got up there, maybe halfway through the Red Wall, and I'm looking, and I'm saying, there's no way.
It's a huge dry fall if you haven't bailed out of the drainage. Right.
Yeah, and it turns out I was like the next drainage to the north
uh-huh.
of where the route actually goes up.
Right.
And so I didn't know that at the time.
Okay.
I didn't, you know, I just knew that this wasn't working out. And so I had to, and of course it's getting late and, you know, very late at that point. And I kind of turned tail and then went back down to the camp and join the rest of the party. So anyways, you know, planning this trip with Art, this was first and foremost in my mind was to try and find this route. Well, we knew we were going to have to find it because that was the objective of our planning. Right.
Right.
So, for some reason, Bruce couldn't come with us on this. And, you know, Bruce did a lot. He does a lot of scenic tours, air tours,
mm-hmm.
as a pilot, and I know that he didn't have the amount of free time that Art had, so
mm.
he couldn't always join us on these trips, but the two of us went up there and drove into the Bass Trailhead, and I don't remember exactly. I think we camped just south of Mount Waithawali. They're on the Esplanade.
Okay.
Because in the morning we got up and we did that climb. We hiked up that peak.
And, okay.
And there was a rattlesnake. I remember seeing that seeing a rattlesnake in the Coconino, which was kind of surprising.
Huh.
And then we hiked around the north side of Waithawali and then out on Spencer Terrace.
Yep.
To Mystic Spring, the old Mystic Spring site.
Okay.
Yep. Which is figured in the, you know, there's a couple of photos of that in George Wharton James' book, and it's really, there's no spring there now, at least when we went there it had all dried up,
mm.
but there was some, you know, remains of stuff like rock slabs and
mm-hmm.
like a ceramic cup or something like that that we found. So this was
cool.
This was kind of neat, you know, to find this famous spot, right, because it had been illustrated. And and then we worked our way around and went down the Bass Trail. So down, didn't even go to the river. We just went down to the Tonto,
right.
And you know, started following that to the west.
Right.
And so we were out, you know, we're kind of just hiking along the Tonto. There's not a lot you can do. But we got to around Wolfenburg Rapids, where the trail, of course, we're above Wolfenburg on the south side of the river. And we're looking off the side of the trail and we can see what looks like a duffel bag or something lying down in the brush, the sage and cactus down off below the trail a little way. So we walk down there and it's a Kelty pack, some sort of a backpack, a frame pack.
Huh.
And we started going through this pack. We find a sleeping bag We find airplane tickets. It was very, very peculiar, and we started thinking, oh my God, somebody's died in here, you know. And so we kind of noted this information. We didn't take anything. We recorded the information about the airplane ticket. And interestingly, we had, now that I think about it, on the way down the Bass Trail, the day prior, we had actually found the remains of a tent, you know, a full-fledged tent with fly in the creek bottom. Just kind of not, it wasn't set up or anything. It had just been kind of, it was just laying there and kind of ripped and torn apart. And we didn't really know what to think of that, of course, at the time either. But then to find this gear, backpack and stuff was very spooky, and we didn't know what to make of it.
Right, and it's not like somebody would have just driven out there and pushed this thing, threw it out of their car. You're quite a ways from the rim. This is a major undertaking to get to that area, and there's somebody's pack.
Yeah, that's right. And so we didn't, we had no what, you know, no idea how to interpret that. And but we've, you know, we took wrote down some information about it, and then continued on our hike. We didn't feel, I guess, it was important enough to go back, you know. And I'm sure we didn't. Well, I don't even know if we had a permit at the time, but we've talked about that in the past, right? And so, but anyways, we decided to continue on the trip, and you know, the Tonto wanders along there, and you get eventually you get down to the river, and past El's Chasm, and we passed the route where I had come down with a friend of mine in the 70s. Well, it would have been maybe 81, down from Royal Arch Creek. I think we talked about that a few weeks ago, months ago. And anyways, we continued our hike from El's, and we at El's, you know, we tried to get up as high as we could, and I don't think we went as high as some of the river runners go. I don't know, you know, as what the absolute limit is for hiking up that creek. You would probably
You
know.
come to the it's a big rappel right off the lip of the Royal Arch, and that drops you down to a little grotto, and you can get up to that little grotto from the river. You have to work at it.
I think, well, we were on, I recall we were on the east side of the creek, and I remember looking across, and I could see just a sliver of the arch. Excuse me, because I had camped under that arch on my previous trip, and I could see just a sliver of it, at least what I thought it was, and then a big drop. So I suspect that looking, I was looking across and over that little grotto you're talking about to the big drop. So I didn't get to the grotto, but it was kind of, you know, tricky going there from what I remember.
So
But anyways.
it gets goofy in there. Now you guys were coming along the Tonto. Did you go down to the river's edge at Garnet and then stay along the river heading downstream? Or did you go up? There's a, you know, there's a little rappel there, so there hopefully there was some fixed ropes. You climb up those ropes, and now you go bench back into Royal Arch Creek, there where the arch is and the little tower.
Oh no. No, we stayed down along the river.
Okay. All
I
right.
had come down that route in like 81
Got it.
with my partner on that
So
hike.
staying along the river, eventually you have to deal with some pretty interesting cliff bits.
Between Garnet and Elf?
No, from Elves downstream to just, it's just
Oh yeah.
a few miles, maybe a mile below. It's 117 is a nice little side canyon coming in, no problem to get to there. But downstream of there, by like 118 or so,
Okay,
it's
it's
a
coming back to me
little
now for sure. And
dicey.
I remember there were like travertine, there's a lot of travertine there. Yes, and so travertine cliffs.
Yep.
and having to work up past those for sure.
Right.
I had completely forgotten that until you just now mentioned it. But
I recall
definitely that there were.
Then you're on the Tonto, but again, the Tonto is getting close to the river. It's pretty flat walking. It's easy going down. Was it Conquistador Isle or Stevens Isle?
Mm-hmm.
Down to Forster, and then down to Fossil. But you're taken out just before there.
Yeah, and so we negotiated those travertine cliffs, and then you get onto nice Tonto, Pete sandstone ledges, right?
And
it's like walking like on a city sidewalk, right? And I remember we stopped at midday at a break where we could drop down to the river,
mm-hmm.
you know, because you're only like 50 feet above the river in most of those places, right? But it's still a continuous cliff, and there was a place north of Apache Point, and Apache Terrace, where we could get down to the river, and there's a little drainage there coming down from Apache Terrace, and I remember we were sitting there on the sandstone ledges, and we had fresh water, cool water, and we're just sitting there, you know, chatting and snoozing, and I look up, kind of like straight up, right? And there's a bighorn looking straight down at me from just above, like 5 feet above me, looking down on us.
Wow.
Yeah, and so they're all in there, as you know, right?
Yeah,
it was quite spectacular. We saw quite a few sightings. And
nice.
And so we went down to Forster and spent a part of a day going up there as far as we could into the various arms. There's only the main southerly arm, but there's a couple of alcoves that branch off of that. And and then we camped I'm not sure exactly where we camped. It might have been maybe at the mouth of Forster, because the next day was our Enfilade Point day.
Right.
And because we were going to go from Enfilade Point from the river up through the Red Wall onto the Esplanade, and then we had to, you know, walk all along the Esplanade
back
to towards
the Bass.
Bass Creek,
which is waves.
There's not a whole lot of water there.
Correct.
And so we had to carry, you know, like I don't know, 3 or 4 gallons or something like that up the Enfilade Point route. Yeah, it was a huge load, and we did it in late afternoon. I remember because the sun would be. You know, off the Red Wall, right, at that time. And so it would be hopefully a little bit cooler for us. So anyways, we started up in late afternoon. And have you done that route?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very elegant route, you know,
it
where
is.
You go up the gully and then you traverse out.
You go up this chute to a ledge, and then the ledge takes you back into the gully above the drop-off that you probably discovered on your river trip.
Well, no, I was in a different drainage totally.
Okay.
Yeah, I was in the next drainage to the north when I did the river trip attempt.
All right.
And so, yeah, so we negotiated it pretty handily. I remember it was no big deal because we had good notes, you know, from Harvey and whatnot. And
got it.
But I do remember we got to the top, and it was getting kind of towards dark, and we were able to. We had to walk a little bit farther to the to get to a reasonable campsite, you know, on top of the Red Wall. But we were just kind of perched up there for sure. It wasn't a very expansive place, and it still wasn't on top of the Esplanade.
Right.
You know, that we did that the next day.
Gorgeous view though.
Oh yeah, yeah, spectacular, because you're looking down, you know, the downriver there through the Middle Granite Gorge, you know, and then you're looking upriver, you know, through Conquistador Isle, and yeah, spectacular setting for sure. So, the next day we basically worked our way up onto the Esplanade, and then started to the south and east, and you know, one of the things that was pretty cool for me to do was we actually walked out to the point that Colin Fletcher took a picture from that was on the cover of his book,
Man Who Walked Through Time.
Man Who Walked Through Time.
Yes.
And, you know, I mean, I know a number, I'm not, a number of people have done this before, but you know, we went to that exact spot and recreated that shot, you know.
Nice.
And so I've actually got that picture on my desk at the office.
Nice.
All these years later, you know.
Huh.
So yeah, I mean, then we followed the Esplanade then for several days, you know, it's very easy, relatively easy going. There's trail here and there,
mm-hmm.
But never continuous. And I remember there was above Forrester, between Forrester and Apache Point, there was a big terrace that had a lot of pinion on it and grasses.
Oh wow!
And there was some sort of a fenced off area that people had put signs on that said, you know, this is a research project underway, and so they were doing some sort of, you know, grassland assessment, looking at, I think they were excluding grazers
right
from the
exactly.
site.
Exactly, a fenced exposure. Yeah.
Right. So it was kind of neat to see that, you know, bit of science being undertaken,
mm-hmm.
and realize that other people are out there, you know, at various times in the year. So,
yeah.
And we just kind of wandered along the Esplanade, getting all these fantastic views.
Mm.
And then we got into Royal Arch Amphitheater, and that was our last campsite. And we laid down under some pinions and had our dinner, and went to, you know, it's dark, so, you know, you eventually shut everything down. And very... very shortly after we went to, you know, got into our sack and,
mm-hmm.
and started to relax, you know, we hear shuffling through our packs, right? And you know, normally it's mice, right? You hear the mice scurrying around your packs, and it's, oh my goodness, you know,
right?
Get the walking sticks out and try and beat the mice or whatever. And you know, eventually you come to a truce, and or you give up and fall asleep, and they just rip open your pack or
exactly.
whatever.
Exactly.
But these were ringtail cats.
Oh wow.
Yeah. So that was pretty neat, and we were kind of fascinated by them, right? It was almost like, oh, you don't have to go away right away. You know,
let's
commune here. Yeah, yeah. So yeah, it was pretty neat to run into that, and the next day was. You know, fairly straightforward. We didn't go around to Bass. I mean, that was, I think I mentioned that at the beginning, but we went up the Point Weitzel Road.
Route. Yes.
Yeah. So, which, what's that?
The borehole, up the pine with a little bit of branches on it, up the crack. And then you pop out this, almost like a manhole cover in this slab of coconut sandstone with a cliff right next to you. And then you walk off the slab, and there's a whole bunch of rock art up in there.
Yeah, for sure. I remember that. Yeah. Yeah, that was spectacular. And we were actually it was kind of interesting because we were heading up that route,
mm-hmm.
and we ran into a hiker.
Huh.
Scott Fibony.
Oh, right.
You
cool.
know Scott, probably.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And he was going down.
Huh.
And so we chat. He was solo. And... and we chatted with him for a little while, and then we parted and, you know, went our separate ways. And so we went and then we went back to our car, right, which was up at Bass Trailhead. And I'm not
mm-hmm.
sure where he was going, but which is kind of interesting because it's not the first – it wasn't the only time we've run into Scott Tybony in the middle of nowhere. So
interesting. Huh.
Yeah, it was an interesting little encounter there. And of course, I don't think I knew really who he was then because he hadn't done a lot of writing.
Got it.
But his brother who was killed in that helicopter plane.
That's
crash.
Exactly right. That's exactly
yeah.
right.
Yeah, and in fact, you know, the pilot of the fixed wing was named Bruce Grubb.
Really?
The pilot of the fixed wing in that accident
huh.
was named Bruce Grubb, and so that is. One of the things that I, you know, had wondered about before I reconnected with Bruce, you know, with Bruce Grubbs,
right.
was whether, you know, he might have been that pilot. But anyways, it's kind of a small world, right?
Yeah.
But to run into him, we had a good chat, right? For sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it was a great trip, you know, a wonderful experience again to and in an area where. I hadn't spent much time, you know, at all. I'd never been in there before, except for the hike down Royal Arch. And I got to finish up because you know, what happened? What about that mysterious backpack we found, right?
Thank you.
Yeah. So so we got back and we went back to Phoenix, and eventually Art contacted, you know, within a couple of days. He didn't wait very long.
Mm-hmm.
He contacted the Park Service and explained to him that we'd been hiking down there and we'd found this gear. And it turns out that there was a couple that had been hiking in there, I think from New Jersey or someplace, and they had gone down into the canyon. I don't know what their exact route was, but it would have been before our trip in October, right? And so, I think it was in September sometime, and they had become overwhelmed by the heat. And so what they did was started discarding gear. And so the pack that we saw was one of the pair's packs.
Wow, okay.
And I think they had left it on the side of the trail, but probably some animal or whatever had, you know, rummaged through it and rolled it down, because it was a fairly steep area of the Tonto there.
Hmm.
And so it had rolled down maybe 20 yards below the trail. And so, they had then gone with one pack and whatever, you know, a minimum amount of gear that they thought they needed, and were heading out the Bass Trail, and that's where they decided to drop their tent. So, in September, they felt like a tent was important enough that, you know, you would keep your tent and leave your backpack and one sleeping bag. I don't understand that rationale, but eventually they dropped their tent as well in the trail up the Bass Canyon.
Huh.
And there was no death or anything like that. Everybody lived to tell their story. But you know, they did lose a fair amount of gear. They left it behind. So yeah, it was very, very, very interesting and kind of instructive, you know.
Yeah.
But you know, well, you've read the book Death in Grand Canyon, right?
Yes. Tom,
I mean, what a wonderful
Michael Guidieri. Yeah.
Yeah. What a fantastic book that is. I read it I don't know, 15 years ago or 20 years ago when it came out first. And, you know, the overwhelming lesson you learn from that book is that the people who are, you know, who are affected, who die, who have really serious consequences, are typically, not always, but typically the people who are unprepared and don't know what they're getting into. And, we know what the allure of the Grand Canyon can mean to people. And I think that a lot of people who come and visit, they have the same ambitions that we do. They want to go hike. They want to go everywhere. They want to explore as much as they can. But they don't necessarily understand what they're getting into. And if you don't have a lot of good understanding and training and in backcountry hiking, and particularly in the desert, you know, you can find, I think, I think a lot of people find that they're quickly overwhelmed.
Yeah,
and particularly when things start to go south, you know, like when the temperature starts to climb, or when you run out of water, right, because you were drinking twice as much as you expected, and that spring that you were looking for is dried up, right?
Yeah.
And you know, if you're not prepared to deal with these kinds of challenges, it can change very quickly in a bad way. And I think that, you know, this for me, finding this this gear here was kind of sobering, because this was a direct example of how things can go bad for people.
Yeah.
You know, I mentioned when we talked a few sessions ago about the time I was down in Hans Creek, and the helicopter dropped in on us because they were searching for a fellow who'd gone missing,
right,
in the area of the Tanner Trail, and you know, that fellow was he died from hypothermia because a snowfall came in and he lost the trail and you know, just couldn't pull it together, keep it together. So, you know, these things happen, but typically I think they tend to happen to people who don't really know what they're getting into. And that's the sense, at least, that I got from death in Grand Canyon. And
it's funny, because one of the things I think of when I think of the book is 500 fatalities going back to 1919 below the rim, and 120 of those happened in one plane crash.
So oh, yeah.
When you look at the numbers, the actual visitors to the park, hikers in the park, and people that die there, it's actually pretty safe. When you kind of work it out over the years, it doesn't mean, you know, you can't kill yourself there, because people have. But
yeah,
I'm kind of comforted by that book, because look at the number. The numbers go, oh, well, it's not that very many people. Maybe I'll make it. So off we go.
yeah. But, you know, I know when my parents, my family used to worry about me,
sure.
know. And so, and they would worry constantly. And you know, I'm so grateful that they didn't make a big deal out of that, you know, that they allowed me to go ahead and do these things actually supported me to do those things. But being able to tell them, even though it was, you know, when did that book come out, 1995 or something?
Mm-hmm.
It being able to tell them and show them that you know, the people who, as you point out, you know, that the odds are not really that bad against you. And I think that was, it was kind of like just confirming, right, and saying, you know, supporting what we'd been saying all the time when we were kids, you know, like, well, we're careful, we're looking after ourselves, you know,
that's
we don't
right.
put our necks out farther than we think we can handle. And so it, yeah, it was kind of comforting and to read that book, but also sobering. So.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so. And what reminds me of a story about, you know, about deaths here, because I haven't been too close to death. I mean, that was a near-death thing. Then there was the trip where the fellow had died on the Tanner just, you know, a day or two
you
before.
You know, Jim, I'm going to jump in here and I'm going to say, because I'm going to take a note of this going, yeah, but that's probably a story I might want to spend some time with. We've been going on for about an hour and a quarter now.
Oh.
Maybe this is a good time to put a comma in here. And we will pick up with part 10, the story about that.
Okay. Yeah, for sure. That sounds great, Tom.
All right.
I'm happy to do that.
Okay, very good. Well, with that, we'll go ahead and conclude part 9 of A Grand Canyon Oral History with Jim Haggart. Today is Sunday, April 4th, 2021. My name is Tom Martin. And Jim, thank you so very much.
Well, thanks for the opportunity, Tom. It's always great chatting with you.
And you too.